financing imports with subsidized dollars, the crisis is mostly linked to the sanctions that the U.S. and its allies have imposed on Lebanon, as well as foreign intervention in the Arab nation's domestic affairs.
While the United States has been trying for more than 15 years, and even more than that, to corner Hezbollah in Lebanon and get the population to rise up against it. It didn't work in 2006 in the war directly with apartheid Israel.
Over 250 of Washington's sanctions targets are in Lebanon or related to the country. And this number has been growing quickly. U.S. sanctions have seriously undermined the stability of the banking sector by reducing the inflow of foreign capital.
So the purposeful crashing of the economy and making life harder for Lebanese people, the United States is hoping that the population in Lebanon would rise up against Hezbollah. And as we've heard from Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Hezbollah will try its best to make sure that this plan doesn't work.
Saudi Arabia has also imposed its own sanctions, including banning its citizens from traveling to Lebanon, where Riyadh-backed elements have been jockeying for position.
Iran has been a major victim of terrorism over the past decades, with over 17,000 Iranians losing their lives in terrorist attacks. Iran has long criticized Western states, especially the United States, for employing double standards in dealing with terrorism. The West's support for anti-Iran terrorist group Mujahideen-e Khalq organization, also known as the MKO, is a case in point. The notorious Mujahideen-e Khalq organization is responsible for the killing of about 12,000 Iranian people and officials since the Islamic Revolution of 1979. The group has carried out bombings and assassinations across Iran. The MKO is a well-known enemy of the Iranian nation with a horrific record that is known to all countries in the region and beyond. During the Iran-Iraq War in the 1980s, the MKO joined forces with former Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein to carry out cross-border attacks. They also helped the former Iraqi dictator to crack down on dissent at home. After the war, MKO members spent many years in a camp in Iraq's Diyala province before being relocated to Albania in 2016. The cult-like group does not tolerate any form of dissent within the organization. Former MKO members who managed to leave the group have painted a grim picture of how the organization treats its members, especially those who intend to leave the MKO. They have reported abuses ranging from solitary confinements to severe beatings and torture. Over the past years, MKO summits have been attended by hawkish U.S. politicians such as former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton, former New York City Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and former Republican House Speaker Newt Gingrich. The U.S. politicians are said to have received hefty sums to attend MKO summits and back the group's calls for regime change in Iran. Observers believe the American and European stances regarding the MKO have exposed their double standards in dealing with terrorism.
When they say that they want to fight terrorist organizations, what they mean is they want to fight every sort of organization that is in any way an obstacle in the further benefit of Western hegemony. We have seen the term terrorism being used over and over and over again to assign any and every sort of organization, even the ones that are not even violent, any sort of organization that opposes imperialism.
The Mujahideen-e Khalq organization was on the U.S. list of terrorist groups for 15 years, but then removed in 2012 to pave the way for the MKO to receive funds more easily. Iran says lobbies in the United States were heavily bribed that year to facilitate the controversial removal. Major European countries, including France, also removed it from their blacklists. Top MKO members, including its public face, Maryam Rajavi, have been moving closer to hawkish U.S. politicians. The deepening ties between U.S. and European governments and Mujahideen-e-Khark terror group suggests that the West may be trying to use the MKO to pressure Iran.
It is not surprising, unfortunately, to see such a close collusion between the MKO and the United States of America. We have seen this happen for the past 30, 40 years. And this has become very clear a couple of years ago, of course, when they held a massive rally in which they invited people such as John Bolton and Rudy Giuliani, some of the most imperialist war hawks that the United States has ever known in the past, let's say, century. So when they attend meetings of the MKO and when they speak there of what they consider the need for, quote-unquote, spreading democracy to Iran, this is what they are trying to achieve. The resurgence of U.S. imperialist control.
How can Western states be supporting this notorious terrorist group and at the same time accuse other countries of backing terrorism?
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight. The disproportionate impact of COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. We now present you an article written by Lauren Aratani under the heading U.S. Community Colleges See Chilling Decline in Enrollment During Pandemic. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. David Ramirez, a student at Pasadena City College in Pasadena, California, struggled with balancing work and classes during the pandemic. David Ramirez, who works at Starbucks, worked at least 30 hours a week in addition to his classes. He wasn't alone. According to the National Student Clearinghouse data released recently, the number of students enrolled in community colleges, local educational establishments that offer two-year courses that are often seen as an affordable stepping stone to higher education, was down 9.5% this past spring, about 476,000 fewer students than in spring of 2020. The fall has experts worried about the long-term impact of the pandemic on the less well-off. During recessions, enrollment at community colleges tends to increase, as those who become unemployed go back to education. But the disproportionate impact COVID-19 had on low-income and non-white Americans, populations that community colleges tend to serve, created a plunge in community college attendance during the pandemic. David Ramirez said, "I didn't really have the option to stay virtual and work from home, so I essentially exposed to this virus every single day. That was a lot to handle on a day-to-day basis and then go home and try to work on schoolwork." He added, "That's the daily experience for students, especially because financial aid for community college doesn't really cover the full cost of attendance. Online classes, especially for science, technology, engineering, and mathematics subjects, were particularly frustrating to manage, as the material was difficult to learn virtually. He said, "I imagine a lot of students simply gave up." While overall college attendance dropped 5% or 727,000 students this spring compared with last year, as many students opted out of virtual learning, community colleges saw the steepest declines when compared to four-year institutions and graduate schools. Enrollment at graduate schools actually increased 4.6% compared with last year. The bulk of enrollment drops at community colleges were seen by schools' younger students, aged between 18 and 24. Separate data from the National Student Clearinghouse has shown a 6.8% decline in graduates of the class of 2020 who attended college immediately after high school, compared to the class of 2019. This means while students with undergraduate degrees were getting advanced degrees in high numbers, many high school graduates chose not to attend college at all this year. Davis Jenkins, a senior research scholar and research professor at Columbia's Teachers College, said the decline in college enrollment among graduating high school students is chilling. Davis Jenkins said, "Delaying college really diminishes your chance of completing college," adding, "particularly if community college enrollment is declining. You take away the opportunity of college for millions of students." Jenkins noted, "It's going to increase the divide between education have and have-nots. Community college students make up about 40% of all undergraduate students in the country, totaling 8.2 million across over 1,400 community colleges, the majority of which are public institutions. Many students who opt to attend community college over a four-year institution do so because tuition can be thousands of dollars cheaper. Two-thirds of community college students come from families with household incomes of under $50,000 a year, and about 45% are students of color." Low-income Americans were hardest hit by the economic repercussions of COVID-19 compared to middle- and high-income Americans, being more likely to lose their jobs and remain unemployed during the course of the coronavirus pandemic. The toll of the pandemic also disproportionately hits Black and Hispanic Americans, who saw COVID death rates that were at least two times higher than white Americans. In a survey of about 25,000 students, community college students were more likely to cancel all plans for college compared to students enrolled at four-year colleges. They were also more likely to have caught, be concerned about, or care for someone who had the virus, and be concerned about the affordability of college. Administrators at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, heard similar concerns from students who were busy caring for family or working and did not see the benefit of attending virtual classes. The school saw a 17% decline in enrollment this past school year. Karen Miller, provost and executive vice president of Access, Learning and Success at Cuyahoga Community College in Cleveland, Ohio, said, "They were definitely affected by this, whether it be a family member who might have contracted COVID or somebody in their family lost a job and they had to go to work instead of coming to school." Some students were concerned about inconsistent Wi-Fi or a lack of quiet spaces to study at home. Karen Miller said the community college had started efforts to get students to re-enroll in the fall, calling, emailing, and texting them to let them know that the school will be back with at least 50% of the in-person capacity. Karen Miller said, "We're trying to re-engage them and let them know that we're going to have an on-ground opportunities, more on-ground classes, and open up our service footprint again come August." She added, "We're hopeful that we're going to see students come back this fall."
They began in the 1960s as an Islamist Marxist student militia against the tyranny of Mohammad Reza Shah of Iran. But when they failed to win the trust of the Iranian nation after the victory of the Islamic Revolution, they turned their guns on the people. Since then, the People's Mujahideen Organization of Iran, known better by its acronym, the MKO or the MEK, has assassinated more than 12,000 civilians over the past four decades. Yet the group has enjoyed full support of the Americans and the Europeans, especially in the past 10 years, amidst tensions between Tehran and the West.
Everyone after five European courts have ruled that the PMI does not belong to the terrorist list.
When Saddam Hussein staged a bloody war against Iran in September 1980, the MKO seized the opportunity to take revenge against the Iranian nation by joining the enemy camp. The Iraqi dictator offered the group weapons, cash, and a vast military base named Camp Ashraf, near the border with Iran. For almost two decades, under the command of Massoud Rajavi, the MKO staged attacks against civilian and military targets across the border in Iran and helped Saddam Hussein suppress his own domestic enemies. Isolated inside the camp, the MKO became cult-like. A report by the RAND Corporation concluded that the group had many of the typical characteristics of a cult, such as authoritarian control, confiscation of assets, sexual control, including mandatory divorce and celibacy, emotional isolation, forced labor, sleep deprivation, physical abuse, and limited exit options. The MKO fell out of favor after the fall of its godfather in the wake of the US-led invasion of Iraq. It brought the group into direct contact with US officials. The US had designated the MKO as a terrorist group in the late 1990s, but hawks like then-Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld and Vice President Dick Cheney argue that the group should be used as a weapon against Tehran. In the end, the Pentagon unilaterally designated MKO members inside Camp Ashraf as protected persons and guaranteed their security in Iraq. In other words, the US protected a group it also designated as terrorists. As early as May 2003, the New York Times reported that Pentagon hardliners were moving to protect the MEK and perhaps reconstitute it later as a future opposition organization in Iran, somewhat along the lines of the US-supported Iraqi opposition under Ahmad Chalabi that preceded the war in Iraq. Between 2007 and 2012, seven Iranian nuclear scientists were attacked and five were assassinated. In 2012, NBC News reported that the attacks were planned by the Israeli regime and executed by MKO agents inside Iran. It was around this time that the terrorist group began working to rebuild its image in the West by launching a lavish lobbying campaign under the leadership of Maryam Rajavi, as Masoud Rajavi has not been seen since 2003. As a result, in 2009, the UK delisted the MKO as a terror group, and a few years later, in 2012, the Obama administration removed the group from the US terror list and later helped negotiate its relocation to Albania and convinced the country to accept the 2,700 remaining members. However, the move from Iraq to the relative safety of Albania has triggered a wave of defections. The testimony of these recent defectors follows earlier reports from groups such as Human Rights Watch, which reported former members witnessed beatings, verbal and psychological abuse, coerced confessions, threats of execution and torture that in two cases led to death. Meanwhile, at the so-called Free Iran Conference that the group stages in Paris each summer, dozens of US and UK representatives openly call for the overthrow of the Islamic Republic and the installation of Maryam Rajavi as the leader of Iran. It is clear that US and UK politicians are not looking for what they call a regime change in Iran, but they are playing a simpler game. In their eyes, backing the MKO is the easiest way to irritate Tehran. As they know, the real power of the terrorist group is hardly more than the assassination of defenseless people. In the words of Paul Pillar, who served in the CIA for 28 years, they are pursuing anything that would disrupt the political order in Iran, so they can cite such an outcome as a supposed victory, no matter what comes afterwards. MKO members in Albania are mostly acting as a cyber army against the Islamic Republic of Iran. According to Mark Owen Jones, an academic who studies political bots on social media, thousands of suspicious Twitter accounts emerged in early 2016 with Iran as their location, which posted in support of the MKO using the hashtags hashtag Iran regime change, hashtag free Iran, and hashtag I stand with Maryam Rajavi. For most of its life in exile, the MKO was financed by Saddam Hussein. After his fall, the group has desperately been looking for a new sponsor, but has always denied it is financed by Saudi Arabia. Yet when the former Saudi intelligence chief, Prince Turki Al-Faisal, attended the group's 2016 rally in Paris and called for the fall of the Iranian regime, it raised suspicions again about the role of Riyadh as the sponsor of this terrorist group. According to Ervand Ebrahimian, a professor at the City of University of New York, the money definitely comes from the Saudis. There is no one else who could be subsidizing them with this level of finance. In an article published in 2018, Al-Bawaba revealed that 3 tons of gold ingots and 4 suitcases of Rolex watches were given to the MKO by the Saudis when the group was still in Iraq. To sum up, the MKO is the epitome of hypocrisy, the enemy of the people, with the blood of thousands of innocent people on its hands. It seeks to present itself as a group in exile that fights for the freedom of the Iranian people. The group reveals hypocrisy at a higher level, whitewashing this cult of terror to further policies against Tehran. This is a textbook example of hypocrisy by the self-proclaimed champions of democracy.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan, and probably did not think that he had any need to do so, says Patrick Cockburn Ryder in an article published under the heading. Rumsfeld was a living symbol of America's plunge into quagmire. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. As U.S. War Secretary between 2001 and 2006, Rumsfeld gloried in his role as America's military chief, avenging 9/11. But his arrogance and inability to adjust to the realities of the Afghan and Iraq wars produced frustration or failure on the battlefield. Maneuver, though, Rumsfeld did to avoid responsibility for the Iraq war. He became the living symbol of America's plunge into the quagmire. Typically, he responded to this by banning his staff at the Pentagon from using the word quagmire along with resistance and insurgents. Rumsfeld started his career as a Republican congressman from Illinois and moved on to serve four Republican presidents. He headed the Office for Economic Opportunity under Nixon, became War Secretary and Ambassador to NATO in the Ford administration. As President Ronald Reagan's special envoy to the West Asia-North Africa region, he traveled to Baghdad to shake hands with Saddam Hussein and assure him of U.S. support in the eight-year war that the Iraqi dictator had imposed against Iran. Rumsfeld comrade Ravitch Saddam reflected American strategy at the time, but it also showed Rumsfeld's liking for people with power and his dismissiveness towards those without it. It was Iraq that turned out to be his nemesis. He promoted his public image as a man who did not blinch when Al-Qaeda flew a plane into the Pentagon on 9/11. He had personally rushed to succor survivors, though witnesses later said stories of his heroism were exaggerated. By that evening, he was giving a press conference from a bunker in the Pentagon, demonstrating that though President George W. Bush might have been evacuated to safety, his war secretary was standing tall. Within hours of the Al-Qaeda attack, Rumsfeld was looking to use it as justification for a war against Iraq. He sent a note to General Richard Myers, vice chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, looking for best info fast, judge whether good enough to hit Saddam Hussein, at the same time, not only Osama bin Laden. This detail, along with much else in this piece, is derived from Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy by Andrew Cockburn. Rumsfeld sought, in his memoir, to evade responsibility for launching the Iraq War, claiming that President Bush had never asked him if he was in favor of it. The excuse is absurd, since the War Secretary had constant one-on-one meetings with Bush, who might well assume that the man in charge of gathering America's armies for the invasion was in favor of doing so. Rumsfeld enjoyed flying around the world in his giant C-17 transport plane, addressing assemblies of U.S. troops, but he was essentially a palace politician. Not only did he have access to the Oval Office himself, but he fought determined campaigns to exclude other top officials from meetings with the president. He was even upset when Jerry Bremer, the newly appointed U.S. Viceroy in Iraq, had a private lunch with Bush in May 2003. Rumsfeld never had much understanding of Iraq or Afghanistan and probably did not think that he had any need to do so because the military might of the U.S. appeared overwhelming. Rumsfeld reacted furiously when the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Eric Shinseki, told a Senate hearing that several hundred thousand troops might be needed as an occupation force after the invasion. Rumsfeld's pretense that he did not favor the Iraqi war is easily disproved, but a better line of defense from his point of view was that almost no members of America's political military elite were opposed to the war at the time. Critics countered this by saying that military officers whose promotion was in the hands of Rumsfeld were unlikely to express skepticism about his plans. Rumsfeld produced a much-quoted but fallacious explanation, which was used to explain why the U.S. was so often caught by surprise by disastrous events in Iraq. He said that some facts were known and others unknown facts. But there are also unknown unknowns, the ones we don't know, we don't know. Rumsfeld said this in 2002 in relation to the shortage of evidence for the presence of weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, and it briefly won him a reputation for intellectual brilliance, but it masked the damning fact that there were no knowns about Iraq that were good reasons for believing that a regime change would lead to a prolonged military and political crisis. We'll be right back.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
June 28, 2021, on the occasion of the National Judiciary Week and the martyrdom anniversary of Ayatollah Martyr Beheshti and other personalities. The jihadi movement in the judiciary branch, initiated by Hujjatul Islam Raisi, has earned the people's trust. Well, it is necessary to thank Mr. Raisi as the judiciary branch is undergoing a transformation. During the 2+ years that he was in charge of the judiciary, he really worked hard and good things were done in that branch. And Mr. Raisi's move in the judiciary was an example of what we always repeat, jihadi movement. Jihadi movement means a serious, round-the-clock, hardworking and motivated movement. The movement launched by him was like this, and thankfully, it has had good results. The most important effect of this movement was that it revived the people's hope for the judiciary, and it made the people optimistic about the judiciary. We receive people's complaints from various organizations. There is a lot of difference in the people's opinion before and after these 2+ years. His services revived hope and confidence in the branch. This is social capital. The people's trust in the active apparatus in the Islamic Republic is a great social capital, and there is nothing equivalent to it. Thankfully, the judiciary branch has accomplished this feat. The necessity to continue the transformation movement in the judiciary branch. Well, now that the judiciary is undergoing a new change, I have to make a few points that, God willing, will be taken into consideration in the future of the judiciary movement. These are exactly the things he just said, and I have written them down as well. First, there is the issue of the transformational approach in the judiciary branch. Of course, transformation in the true sense of the word does not happen in a year or two, but the beginning of this movement in the judiciary and the adoption of this orientation and this approach was very important. It must continue. It must not stop. Rather, it must intensify. Naturally, if you start a movement and if you want it to produce the desired results, then not only should the movement not see a hiatus in the middle of the way, but it should also intensify and be strengthened so that it can reach the final destination.
Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah. Alhamdulillah, Alhamdulillah, all praises to Allah, all praises to Allah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Around the World with Reporters.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paveway series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al Thara Park and Al Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weigh of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and children. This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban attacks, mainly on key cities and districts across the country, and an assault launched on Saturday. Most of the suburbs of Ghazni city in southern Afghanistan came under Taliban control.
The attack pushed back Afghan forces into the city as they struggled to avoid the collapse of the strategic area, which is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway.
Officials in Ghazni say Afghan security forces are strongly resisting in the city, noting that dozens of Taliban militants, including foreign nationals, have been killed as a result of counter-attack operations by Afghan security forces.
The enemy has captured some areas in the suburbs of the city. This is because we tactically retreated from those areas. They also made efforts to enter the city, but we pounded them hard and pushed back the terrorists from the city.
This comes as thousands of locals have also stood alongside the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces to resist against the Taliban, a move which has been supported by influential figures and locals in Afghanistan.
Our great nation has always proved to be alongside the country's national security and defense forces. Our people will once again resist against the Taliban now that the militant group wants to expand its military grip.
Apart from consequences like rising violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of local Afghans have so far been displaced inside the country. In such circumstances, Maneher urged both the Afghan government and the Taliban to rather focus on political solutions to resolve their difference than engaging in a deadly conflict. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Scores of Palestinian fishermen staged a protest against the ongoing Israeli violations against them in the Sea of Gaza. The Israeli siege imposed on the fishing area for 15 years has deteriorated the lives of Gazan fishermen who are dependent on the fishing industry and has badly affected Gaza's economy.
The raw materials required for repairing our nets and boats are not allowed to enter Gaza. This has deteriorated the condition of most fishermen in Gaza. For 15 years, the Israeli regime has intended to close down fishing zones in fishing seasons.
The fishermen syndicate in Gaza organized a protest in Gaza's port. There was also a press conference aimed at highlighting the Israeli abuse against fishermen, namely opening fire at them, arresting them, and droning fishing boats.
I lost my brothers and I lost my money and my source of income as the Israeli regime bombed my boat in 2014. And here I am, participating in this protest while human rights groups turn a blind eye to what is happening to us.
During the latest Israeli offensive on Gaza, Israel closed the sea completely. Since the end of the onslaught on 21st May, Israel has opened the sea for fishermen only for 6 miles, which is not enough for fishermen to get enough fish to help them make money or even provide enough fish for consumers.
The inhumane Israeli blockade has restricted our work for 15 years now. Most of fishermen now lack fishing nets and equipment due to the closure of borders. The Israeli regime is trying to destroy the Palestinian income by any means. The occupiers intend to make us isolated and restrict our daily work.
Under the Oslo Agreement, the fishing range was 20 miles. However, over the years, the Israeli military gradually reduced this range, severely damaging the livelihoods of thousands of fishermen. The humanitarian situation in Gaza is worsening due to the Israeli blockade, which is taking its toll on the life of 2 million Palestinians. Fishermen here in Gaza call on the international community to pressurize Israel to end these restrictions that threaten their daily lives and make it hard to maintain any source of income. Ruba Shavit, Gaza.
Since the beginning of the Saudi-led coalition war against Yemen in 2015, thousands of Yemenis, including businessmen, have been forcibly displaced from Saudi territories due to their sympathy with their country. Others have been imprisoned and tortured on charges of being Houthis.
The Saudi authorities practice various types of violations against Yemenis residing in the kingdom. The number of forcibly displaced people from Saudi Arabia, according to the International Organization for Migration, has reached more than 49,000. Saudi Arabia began practicing enforced disappearance and torture of Yemenis because of their sympathy with the countrymen since the beginning of war. This is considered a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Abdul Latif al-Hashimi is one of those displaced from Saudi Arabia. He has established a foundation in Sana'a to expose the Saudi practices against Yemenis and to help those who feel alienated upon their arrival in Yemen after spending decades of their lives in Saudi Arabia. Al-Hashimi says some Yemenis have been displaced or imprisoned because of their last name if it refers to a Hashimi family.
There are Yemenis imprisoned in Saudi Arabia on charges of being Houthis, belonging to a particular sect, or because of their last name if it refers to Hashemite family. Even those who show sympathy with their countrymen suffering from the Saudi war and blockade are imprisoned. Others have their money and trade confiscated. We seek to help those who are deported to Yemen, as most of them feel alienated upon their return to Yemen.
Saudi Arabia and its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 to reinstate a friendly regime there. The brutal war has killed tens of thousands of civilians, most of them women and children.
The grievance of forcibly displaced Yemenis from Saudi Arabia exposes another aspect of Riyadh's violations of the humanitarian law. People here say all this comes amid the apathy of most international human rights bodies. Latif Al-Washali, Sana.
More than 2,000 Palestinian teenagers have attended a summer camp held by the Islamic Jihad armed wing to get more familiar with the Palestinian cause and receive due military training for possible confrontation with the Israeli army.
The camp aims to raise the awareness of the Gaza teenagers about the Palestinian cause. Israeli regime thinks that by waging war, it can undermine the spirit of our nation. Camps like this make our children prepared to stand up for their rights against the Zionist violence.
The camp was inaugurated in a ceremony attended by a number of political and military leaders of the Islamic Jihad movement. The leaders said the camp seeks to make the new generation more familiar with the Palestinian cause and demolish the concept of normalizing ties with Israel in their minds.
This camp aims to give training to the young generation on the resistance front's war strategies against the Israeli regime. A number of participants have lost one or more relatives during the latest escalation, and they are here to learn how to cope with the next atrocities.
The number of participants this year was significantly higher compared to previous years. The resistance factions attribute this huge participation to the big victory they achieved against Israel in the last escalation over the Strip.
We came here to learn how to defend our lands. We want history to write about us and how we seek to liberate Jerusalem al-Quds. My message to the Israeli occupation is that the youngest olive tree in our land is older than your whole entity. We are the generation that witnessed wars and killings, and that's why we will keep the resistance and will not give up our land.
The Islamic Jihad says these camps also carry a message to Israel that the Palestinian factions are always ready to defend their rights. Observers here say among its responsibilities, the resistance front should narrate the true history of resistance for new generations to help them understand the true face of the Israeli regime. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Latest figures from the International Organization for Migration show so far this year 898 refugees have died in the Mediterranean Sea while trying to reach EU soil. That's three times more compared to the same period last year. The subject has, yet again, just been debated in the European Parliament.
Europe is no longer in a migration crisis.
That remark by EU Home Affairs Commissioner Ylva Johansson has incensed many lawmakers.
It is quite surprising to be here listening to this debate and suddenly the Commissioner says the EU is no longer in a migration crisis. Commissioner, what planet are you living on?
Legislators and rights groups highlight reports that EU countries such as Greece and Italy are aggressively pushing refugee vessels away from their shores. Other EU nations like Austria and Hungary have closed their borders to these desperate people. A €6.3 billion fund has been agreed by the European Parliament to help member states manage the refugee issue.
We first need to see improvements in respect for fundamental rights and accountability, and this funding should be made conditional upon fundamental rights compliance.
The EU is continuing its policy of sending billions of euro to Turkey and Libya so that authorities there prevent the flow of refugees to the 27-nation bloc.
Throughout this, European leaders keep resorting to populist solutions of making it harder and harder for people to reach safety.
Campaigners say at no point since the crisis started in 2015 has the EU taken responsibility. They say the main source of the problem relates to attempts by Western powers to destroy and take over Syria. Now EU leaders are being urged to show some compassion and solidarity.
Finally, take political responsibility to break the deadlock in the Council and to agree on a common European asylum system.
However, rights groups say that is wishful thinking. Anti-refugee politicians, such as Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban, have the power to veto any proposals that are presented here. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
The global call for reparations is growing louder by the day as news emerges that Jamaica's government is set to demand reparations from Queen Elizabeth II and the British government for Great Britain's role in the transatlantic slave trade. A petition has been prepared and will be submitted in due course, according to Olivia Bazby-Grange, Jamaica's Minister for Culture. The announcement comes not long after UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet urged global action, including reparations, to, quote, make amends to people of African descent.
And of course, it's long, long, long overdue. And I like the way that the Jamaican representatives have phrased it. They have said, quite frankly, that if we're prepared, or if Britain is prepared to repay the enslavers or the descendants of the enslavers up until, just a few years ago, yeah, then they must equally be prepared to repay the descendants of the enslaved.
Over 3 million enslaved Africans were forcibly trafficked across the world by the British Empire to their colonies, including Jamaica, to work on plantations while being habitually brutalized and dehumanized. Yet for this heinous crime, the British state has never formally apologized, let alone taken steps to ensure reparatory justice.
Meanwhile, when slavery ended, the UK government borrowed £20 million from the Treasury to compensate slave owners for the inconvenience of not having enslaved Africans to make them rich. The loan was one of the largest in British history, which was equivalent to £17 billion today, and was at the time 40% of the UK's national budget. Yet according to the Daily Express newspaper based in the UK, 97% of their readers polled voted no to the question of whether Britain should pay reparations.
If you speak to the average Briton who doesn't know the true history of Britain, they're proud of empire. They think empire is something good. So the idea that they must, make payment for their ill deeds, their wrongful deeds, that doesn't even occur to them.
Britain is not going to apologise because there is no compulsion to apologise. That's what we're dealing with. Reparations is ultimately about power, okay? It's not about right or wrong or what's just or unjust. It's about who has the power to enforce their will.
Jamaica is a small island nation with a population of just under 3 million that still has the British Queen as its unelected head of state. And while many people of African descent will welcome their latest demand for reparations, others will feel that it will take a lot more than a petition to get the British state to finally accept responsibility for their historic crimes. Ahmed Cabello, London.
A Muslim woman from Birmingham is considering legal action against West Midlands police after allegedly being arrested while chanting in support of Palestine on Tuesday. The story went viral on social media after footage of the arrest was shared by Palestine Action, who were staging a separate stunt opposite where the woman was cuffed.
Under what power are you taking her away? She was just standing on the street.
Three officers decided to come my way and start asking me to basically stop chanting, and then I challenged them and asked them, it's my right to chant, I'm outside the building, I'm not doing anything wrong, and they refused. They said, well, if you carry on chanting, then we will arrest you. And I said, well, what law have I broken? On what grounds? And they had no answer again. They were becoming very agitated, and I was speaking very calmly. And to my shock, one of the officers just grabbed my hand and handcuffed my wrist without any warning whatsoever. They were ignoring me, and then when I asked them, how long are you going to keep me in custody for? Their reply was basically, until the activists on the roof get down, and when it's all over.
Ware contacted the police for comment. They claimed she was arrested to prevent a breach of the peace, and only de-arrested her after she was pressured to